C1T. Chapter 13, Teaching Christian Science. The Structure of the Christian Science Textbook, Our Way of Life. Number 1A.
Well, we take this week the chapter on Christian Science Teaching, and the following chapter Recapitulation. And this is in sequence to a series that I have started way back in London in 1956 until 58, when I was presenting the first five chapters of the textbook. Then I made a break, and later on in 1966, also in London until 1968, I was presenting the next three chapters, that was Science, Theology and Medicine, Physiology and Footsteps of Truth. Then I made a new break and started with the ninth chapter here in America, 1978. Last year we did the chapter on practice, and this week the chapter on Christian Science teaching and recapitulation, and next year I will take the chapter Genesis. I say this just for those students, few students who are here for the first time and therefore are not perhaps acquainted with the presentation of the Christian Science textbook as a structure, as I have been given this structure since the 1955 and 56. I want to say that this is a continuation, and therefore I ask of those new students that they be fair in their criticism towards me if in the course of this week I may mention various things which they may not understand, perhaps a few terms that they are not familiar to them. There may not be many at large. I think everyone who knows the textbook should be able to follow to a certain extent. But I want to give this talk not just for these students here, for this group here, but actually, as you see, for the recording, so that it stays for the next 10, 20, or 30 years. It's therefore a presentation that I make for the future also, not only just for you, and therefore be patient with me and not too critical if perhaps here or there I may present something that is not understandable right away, though I think it should be understandable. As you see, up to this point I have been presenting the first four sets or three sets of four chapters, namely the four chapters on the Word, four chapters on the Christ, and the four chapters on Christianity. So with this chapter here, we begin the last of those four sets, the chapters on science. And therefore these four chapters that we will do this year, next year, and the year afterwards cover the fourth side of the city, namely the fourth side being science. Now, we start with the chapter on teaching. Every time one investigates a chapter as a whole and would like to interpret it scientifically and therefore system-wise, and not just as a individual inspiration, but system intrinsically, then the very first thing one must do is to see if by reading through the chapter, one can catch that main theme that flows right from the beginning to the end through the chapter. This is the first approach that one does if one wants to investigate the chapter scientifically and not just inspirationally. That one asks that great question, what is the scientific idea that flows right through from the first to the last page? And in order to find that out, actually one needs quite a bit of spiritual sense and also quite a bit of scientific sense. And only when these two go together, then one has a chance to hear really the theme that is running through it. So this would be for anyone who approaches any subject, be it the book of the Bible, be it a chapter of the textbook, would be the first step of scientific interpretation. Now, here I present to you the result of the scientific interpretation, because in a class like this we can't say now we first, each one of us reads that chapter through about 5, 6, 8 times, just slowly listening to the tonality, listening what is the unique message of this chapter, listening of how this chapter differentiates from the other chapters, what is the subject that which is in it that we never found in another chapter, what is that new theme that runs through it. Now this is naturally a culturing that only each one would be able to do all by himself, alone, really in the quietude of prayer and meditation and listening to the voice of God. So the great idea that runs right through this chapter, I think, is this, that we feel that two main tones that are wedded together really run through it. The one great tone is, you will certainly feel when you read this chapter, is a great sense of the ethics of Christian Science. That's a new subject that has never been touched upon in the preceding chapters, and therefore is quite new for it. And here Mrs. Eddy speaks a lot about the ethics of Christian Science. Not about ordinary ethics, it is the ethics of science, and she explains right away what this ethics is, namely that it is strict adherence to the divine principle and its rules. So you can see that ethic consists in a scientific approach to the principle of being, namely in that strict adherence to God's requirements, she says, also to strict adherence to the rules of metaphysics. All this is what she feels here is necessary for teaching. The central note, perhaps, that we can take out of the text is that very soon after the beginning of the chapter, she speaks about this ethics of Christian Science and presents an ethic that is completely new for the whole world. Namely, that she says that the ethics of Christian Science is what? That all is mind. Can you hear something quite terrific? All is mind. It isn't a moral demand that she puts forward here as the ethics. It is an absolutely divine demand. It is on a level that is scientific, that has nothing to do with the human. So that ethics is that all is mind, and that the scientist must conform to God's requirements. So here we have a definition of her sense of ethics. Now, we want to investigate a little bit that whole sense of ethics, as it is a central theme. And so let's just contemplate a little bit what ethics means, what is the right sense of ethics, what is a human sense of ethics, what is a divine sense of ethics. And so let us just first perhaps see that ethics has a lot really to do with doing good. Because if we take the definition from Webster about ethics, there Webster says the chief problem with which ethics deals concerns the nature of the highest good. So she equates, so to say, equates, so to say, ethics with doing the highest good. But what is the highest good? What is good? So the whole question of ethics or of the 13th chapter is predominantly also a question of understanding what is meant by the term good. There is an epigraph that covers the whole textbook. Right at the beginning, Mrs. Eddy gives that statement as an epigraph of the textbook from Shakespeare. There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Well, this gives food for thought, because here good doesn't seem to have a value in itself. She says, or Shakespeare says, but she means it also, or she wouldn't put this at the beginning of the textbook, that she says, look here, good is, so to say, something that is beyond the question of good and evil. Actually, what is good is, in general, I must put that, in general, or on the human level, really only that what we attribute to something. It is by itself neither good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. Now, thinking is a human subjective view, and a human subjective view has certainly nothing to do with a divine view, with a divine standpoint. So we begin to see something very interesting, that right at the beginning of the textbook, Mrs. Eddy indicates that the term good can be a very, a term that means many things, that can be interpreted in many ways, if it is dependent on our thinking. Which means what? Which means that the way she uses there the term good is a relative value. It's an absolute relative value. It depends on thinking. Thinking makes it so. So, good, therefore, as a relative value, is to be considered here, and therefore also it is nice to know that really the stem of good is valuable, therefore evil is useless. So here in this way we begin to feel that there are many ways of evaluate good and evil. It all depends on the humanly subjective standard. That is why you know that in so many countries you have different ethics, different morals, different standards, what is good, what is evil, so that the ethics or the moral changes from culture to culture, from nation to nation, from age to age. The ethics of the last centuries or of the is not the same as the ethics of today. The ethics of another religion, like Islam, is another ethics than what we have today in the Christian era. And so you can realize that term good has quite an ambivalent meaning. Can be this or this. Yes, so what shall we do with such an ambivalent meaning, such a value that is so changing? In a science we can't have identities that are changing or terms that are changing. We need identities that remain what they are so that we really can count with them. Now, this has always been the great question in philosophy and in religion, because ethics is a department of philosophy. It was always the great question, now, what is really the highest good? Are they absolute valuable values of good? And all through the centuries, no philosophy could bring out a theory which would be satisfactory and which would be able to show, yes, there are absolute values of good. That was impossible up to Mrs. Eddy. So all these ethics somehow had a great weakness, that they were dependent on subjective evaluation of good and evil. Now, how can we see a solution to that whole problem? What is the ethics in science? Well, in ordinary science, let's say classical science, the classical aspect and concept of science says that every science is value-free. Science is undertaken free from subjective approach, or free from subjective values. It must be absolutely objective, so that no subjective evaluation would enter in. And so it is absolutely clear that you can be a very great scientist in the world of the sciences, and yet quite a rotten character. That's absolutely possible, and the experience shows that. Because science should be value-free. That's what the science usually is, what is demanded of a science. Now, therefore, we could say in the classical aspect of science, we see that ethics has no value system, has no value system in science, because it has no ethics, and therefore science is free from an ethic. It is not ethical, but it is not unethical. It is aethical, just free from ethics. So we can't say science is unethical because the scientists have produced the atom bomb. That's not unethical. It's because the scientists can also produce something that is very good and ethical. So it is neither ethical nor unethical, but we really could say that science up to now has been considered to be aethical. You know, a before the ethical. That means always free from. Not against, it is not unethical, it is just free from being ethical. It's neutral. Now, you know that since the experience in Hiroshima, scientists have began to wonder if this attitude of science is really right. If really it is right that the scientist says, I don't need to give any value to what I discover and to what I research. That's not my business. My business is just to find out the truth. What is going to happen with what I find out, that's not my business. So they begin to question if really this concept of science is the right concept of science. Somehow they feel it's not the right concept of science. And there are, in the last 10, 15 years, and you know that very well, it started very much over here with, at that time, with Oppenheim and with Teller and all these people, you remember, with the H bomb and so on, that great discussion started right away. Well, shouldn't we have a science that is ethical? And in a way they began to see that this should be possible, though up to now they haven't found an answer, but still they feel that there is some kind of indication that they say, well, science is engaged in finding the truth, and the truth is a value. So in a way, science has values. It's not value-free. It is engaged in values. It searches truth and nothing but the truth and does not want to be engaged in error. So little by little you can see that that there is a movement in the present age, in the trans-classical period, that we can say that there is a search for a science that is ethical and not value-free. So that the demand is that the science should actually be good and not just neutral, but that science should be good. And therefore it is not surprising really, you know, that Mrs. Eddy speaks of the science of good. And you can see at once at this point that apparently Mrs. Eddy, 100 years ago already, she was always a forerunner of what came into the world. She always was about 100 years ahead of what the world will find out afterward. She 100 years ago began to see there must be a science of good and science must be good. But how on earth could she bring or could she show that science is ethical and that there is an ethic in science? I just came across a statement from Bertrand Russell, you know, the great philosopher and logician. He said the following, and if you read it, you really could feel, well, this could be from Mrs. Eddy's hand. He said, we need a standard of values, which, if scientifically understood, would have the effect that it would make us do in an irresistible way the right thing without trying to be good through a mere moral codex. Shall I read it again? It's so good because it seems to show what I want to show over a whole period, that it says, I translated it from the German into English, so I don't know if the English is right. Usually, I mean, he stated it in English and then it was translated into German and I picked it up in German and had to translate it back into English. So I don't know if it's exactly the original, but as it just happened to fall into my hands a few days ago, I give it to you. The main thing is the meaning in it. As I said, we need a standard of values. Now, you know that Mrs. Eddy has given a standard of values. She has said, the only values that are really values are the ideas of mind, the ideas of spirit, the ideas of soul, principle, life, truth, and love. These are our values, and that's the standard of values. So, we need a standard of values which, if scientifically understood, would have the effect. What kind of effect? That it would make us do in an irresistible way the right thing. See, if we would understand, instead of moral and moral values, if we would understand the values of ideas, the standard of ideas, if we would understand them, they would make us to be ethical. They would have the effect that they would make us do the right thing, and they would make us to do the right thing in an irresistible way. We couldn't help but doing them. Wouldn't that be an ethic, huh? Wouldn't that be a real moral science, huh? Without trying to be good, wouldn't that be wonderful if we would stop being goody-goodies, huh? And constantly trying to try and show how good we are, even if we don't feel that way, but at least try to show outwardly to be good through a mere moral codex. That's actually, you see, what 100 years before Mrs. Eddy felt, that there is a standard of values, and that those standard of values are values. They are not valueless. They are not neutral. And therefore, good is a value that is closely connected with ideas. That ideas are good. Ideas can't be evil. So that if we understood ideas, everything that flows out of a consciousness of ideas must be good, no matter if it coincides with a moral standard of a religion, or a moral standard of a nation, of a moral standard of a period, of a moral standard of whatever is going on. So, if we see that Christian Science presents that standard of values, we begin actually to see that Christian Science is not value-free, as any other science is, or wanted to be. It's no more value-free. It's a science of true values, and therefore the science of good. We can understand why the first title of the booklet that Mrs. Eddy ever brought out, that booklet which contained more or less recapitulation, had the title The Science of Man, by which the sick are healed, or Questions and Answers in Moral Science. So first she defined her discovery actually as the science of man and as moral science. And only afterwards she called it Science and Health and Christian Science. So here we have it, that in Christian Science, good is God. And so we have to make a new paradigm shift to see that God is that which has values, and only these values are good, and that we must not find good within ourselves. As Shakespeare said, that there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So that old paradigm was that thinking makes something good and evil. That thinking was that which established a moral codex. Now we come to the paradigm shift, which says, no, it's the other way around. God is good and has a standard of value, and therefore only ideas are good.